Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Silvia Allegretto, who's a labor economist and co-chair of the Center on Wage and Employment Dynamics at the University of California, Berkeley. She has co-authored several editions of The State of Working America, and her research interests include long-term unemployment, family budgets, low-wage labor markets, inequality, and minimum wages. Welcome to Background Briefing, Silvia Allegretto.
Hey, it's good to be here.
And the president laid out a fairly inspirational speech saying that he was going to dedicate the rest of his term to trying to reverse the relentless decade-long trends of growing inequality and the lack of social mobility in this country, saying that the growing gap between the rich and the poor was the defining challenge of our time. Now we're witnessing We witness on Black Friday strikes against or demonstrations against Walmart for not paying a living wage. And now across the country, fast food workers are demonstrating. We just spoke to one of the organizers of a demonstration in New York just before talking to you. And now we also learn that bank tellers, at a time when banks are making record profits, bank tellers are not making a living wage.
Yes, I think there's been a lot of exciting news on the front of something that I've cared deeply about for a long time, and that is inequality and the plight of low-wage workers. I think that when we put out the report on fast food workers, the core frontline fast food workers, and we've documented that over half of them and their families are on public subsidies, I don't think many people were that surprised, probably, because they know that fast food workers are low-wage workers. But I do think that the bank tellers, most of us, I think, you know, you go into a bank and you see a very professional, very nicely dressed bank teller. You know, you think of that in your mind as kind of a mid-career professional job. And so the fact that we find that over about a third of these bank tellers are on public subsidies, and that they're the typical wage of a bank teller is less than $12 an hour or less than $25,000 a year for a full-time worker, I think it's a little bit shocking.
So, and this, of course, is contrasted to the extraordinary pays and bonuses that bankers get, and banks are making a record profit. And this is, of course, a trend that's been going on for some time, as the president has referred to, this relentless decades-long trend. So what is driving the middle class into extinction? And, you know, we, as you pointed out, we normally associate people that work in banks with a kind of middle class job, but now they're getting they're not even getting living wages. So what is driving this trend of downsizing Americans?
Well, you're very right. This is really a trend that started in the mid-1970s or so, and there's several reasons, probably many more than I even know about. But, of course, one reason that we see is the decline of unionization. We used to have well over a third of our private sector was unionized. Workers were able to count on their unions and the bargaining process to make sure that they got a share of the ever-expanding economy and of a workforce that was becoming more and more productive. And that was severed in the mid-1970s. And so you see this big divergence between what workers are getting and what workers are producing, their productivity levels, which have been soaring. And also over these decades, the economy has been growing vastly. So you're very right in that the richest economy and largest economy and some of the most productive workers in the world aren't being shared with the majority of the workers who make it so. And one of the reasons, again, is this decrease in unionization, surely. But we also see that we just don't have the daylight between Washington and Wall Street and lobbyists that should be. We're in this kind of really vicious cycle of wealthy people, by dint of their wealth and their power, are able to gain access to the political process, political power, and then the policies that basically beget them more wealth. This is what we've been seeing over the last 30 years. And so we don't have the broadly based shared prosperity that we had post-World War II all the way into the mid-70s. It's kind of two periods of time, one that was where we were really being prosperous and the gains were widely shared prior to 1970, and then post-1970, 75 or so, where that hasn't been the case. And it becomes less and less so over time. For instance, since the Great Recession, once we started getting GDP in the positive territory and output actually being positive again, even though it was kind of tepid. 96% of those gains since around mid-2009 have gone to the top 1%. So it's actually gotten much worse this side of the Great Recession.
Again, I'm speaking with Silvia Allegretto, who's a labor economist and co-chair of the Center on Wage and Employment Dynamics at the University of California, Berkeley. She has co-authored several editions of The State of Working America, and her research interests include long-term unemployment, family budgets, low-wage labor markets, inequality, and minimum wages. Now, you mentioned the pay for bank tellers, which was normally considered a kind of middle-class job, and it has all of the outward trappings of a middle-class job, but next time you go to the bank, you'll have to recognize the fact that the person that's helping you or serving you there, a third of tellers, their medium hourly wages in 2010 were $11.59. And contrast that to what the Wall Street has earned. Their average wage is $362,950 in 2010. So there you have in stark detail the growing inequality gap in this country that the president addressed. What's your sense, Silvia, about all of the propaganda that we've had over the years and this whole mythology of Horatio Alger, the American dream, upward mobility, the meritocracy? So much of our mythology in this country is about upward mobility and people with talents and who are prepared to roll up their sleeves and work hard. The sky's the limit. Well, as the president said yesterday, people work their tails off, fast food workers work their tails off and barely keep above poverty.
Yeah, I mean, when I go out and do my talks and show my PowerPoints around the country, people are usually stunned when I show them the slides that illustrate that we have less mobility, for instance, in the U.S. than even Canada, for instance. One of the reasons we have less mobility, and that's actually getting worse over time, is because we have such disparity in income. So, kind of, if you will, the steps on our economic ladder are there. You know, it's so vast. Our ladder is kind of so much larger that we have many people at the bottom and a very few people at the very top. It's hard to transverse such a ladder. And it's very, very hard. And most of the data that we have now is showing that, you know, where you start dictates more where you end up than anything else. So if you start kind of in the bottom, you're probably most likely going to end up in the bottom. Maybe there is a bit of mobility. Certainly there is some mobility, but not anywhere like people would like to believe here in the land of opportunity. And like I said, this is becoming less so. We're having a permanent lower class. Our working class folks are doing much, much worse and falling behind more and more, like you said, a long-term trend. And those at the top, though, are doing very, very well.
Well, actually, it was the president who said it's a long-term trend.
Well, it is a long-term trend. That's
right.
Very well documented.
Right.
It's just something we haven't talked about for most of the last 30 years as it's been going on. But believe me, this is a trend that started back in the mid-70s and has only worsened recently.
So, Silvia Allegretto, when you do your PowerPoints, and you said that the public that you address are surprised by the information that you give, and they're shocked to learn how deep and pervasive income inequality is in this country, and the lack of social mobility, and the growing gap between the rich and the poor. Do you point out to your audiences, for example, that, you know, in terms of what we're talking about, bank tellers' wages, not getting a living wage compared to the bank's profits and the top wages for bankers on Wall Street, averaging out in 2010 at $362,950, as opposed to $11.59 an hour for tellers. The people that you're talking to, average American taxpayers, they have to subsidize these banks for not paying their workers a living wage to the tune of about $1 billion a year. Does that get their attention?
It seems so. It seems that this idea of having people get up, go to work every day, and have to rely on public subsidies, well, you know, to some degree, that's a good thing, right? We do want our lowest wage workers, if they need a little bit more, if they need a little bit more help, we as American taxpayers usually think, you know, we can do that. We can provide food stamps to poor families, even poor working families. But it should be a last resort, not like a typical course of business. And it seems like with the, certainly with the fast food workers and certainly with these banks, you know, they could pay higher wages, but they don't. And it's not like they're doing anything wrong. They're paying at least minimum wages or low wages. And that's why the minimum wage policy is so important right now. It's one of the easiest, quickest things that we can do is raise the minimum wage. And by the way, the minimum wage polls really well. I mean, Democrats, something like close to 80% of Democrats think the minimum wage should be increased, and over 50% of Republicans. And you have to ask yourself, if most of the populace and the, you know, voting voters in the United States want the minimum wage increase, why doesn't it get done? Why don't the representatives in Washington, D.C. make sure this gets done? We rarely agree on something at these high rates, you know. But it doesn't. And, of course, one of the reasons is because they have to fight the lobbyists, and the moneyed interest in Washington are more powerful than their constituents' interest and desires back home.
So when the president said the opportunity gap in America now is as much about class as it is about race, which I think is something that's overdue in our national debate, that we have more in common in terms of class divisions than we do in terms of race divisions, because so many, I don't know what the percentage are, who are poor in this country, but the majority of them, the vast majority of them are white. So what's your sense then of that new narrative? Because it seems to be overdue. And I've noticed in this culture that, you know, you can't talk about class. It's as though it doesn't exist in America, when clearly if you have the one of the greatest amounts of income inequality in the world, how can you not be a class society?
Well, I think you're right there. I mean, we don't really talk about class that much in the U.S. And there are definite parallels between race and class. But for instance, it is true that most of the people in poverty in this country are white, but poverty still affects, for instance, African Americans disproportionately more so. So you have both of those things going on. I think the narratives of race and class together should be what we're talking about. But we don't talk about either of them in this country very much. And I'm reading a great book now called The New Jim Crow, and it's just disturbing how we have so many African American men in the prison system, for instance. And that, by and large, was due to policy, not because they happen to be criminals at higher rates. And that's something that we need to look at, because it's very much tied into the economic situations of some of our most beloved cities, and I include the city that I live in, Oakland, California. This idea of talking, having a narrative of race and class, I think both of them are very, very much in need in today's, not just in for our economics, but for our democracy, really, because I believe that these problems that we have, such as mass incarceration, such as this vast divide between the haves and the have-nots, is not only a problem for our economics and for our economic system, it's a problem for our democracy.
So given that the president is speaking up, and of course the president has 37 months left, and he's not running for re-election because he can't under the Constitution, although I suppose he could go back to being a senator, but right. Not exactly likely. He's speaking up. But, you know, to tell you the truth, Sylvia, the only people I've noticed, curiously enough, that have really spoken up about class division and the growing income disparity have been billionaires like Warren Buffett, who warned that we are becoming a plantation economy. Bill Gates' father has also campaigned against income inequality and talked about how rich people can't sail two yachts at the same time. What do you make of the lack of populist rhetoric on the political left in this country?
Well, I think it's there. I mean, certainly folks like me and where I'm a research associate and used to work, the Economic Policy Institute has been over 25 years talking about these same problems. So they have been, they were one of the first on the scenes to document a lot of these problems. You have other progressive economists like Dean Baker and John Schmidt and Aaron Dubay and my colleagues here at the Institute for Research on Labor and on Labor and Employment. They're out there, but we don't usually get our due. You know, people are, I mean, we have 24 hours news channels that are devoted to riches and the stock market. We don't have a 24-hour news channel for the plight of the working class in this country. And I also think that the working class has figured out what's been going on, but they don't have a voice. I mean, why are people listening to Warren Buffett? I mean, because he's rich, basically. I mean, it's great he's saying a lot of the same things that I would be saying, but he's got the voice because he's wealthy, basically. Mm. So, you know, what even gets displayed in the news media, what's on your TV, that has a lot to do with the income inequality itself. But I do think that having the president on board, having progressive voices like Bernie Sanders, for instance, Elizabeth Warren, I do think we need a populist movement. And whether we get it or not, I'm not sure. But I do know that Americans who have been reeling and continue to reel from the Great Recession, as they turn on their TVs and see this stock market booming at 16,000, CEO pay through the roof, corporate profits so healthy, they sit and look at their own paychecks and say, what's happening? Why can't I even get a good job? Why have my hours been cut? Why have my wages not gone anywhere? Not just over the Great Recession, but for the last 10 years. And they see that we're the richest country in the world. They know we're the hardest workers in the world. And I think that they are starting to get fed up, and that's why we're seeing these worker movements.
Well, I was actually referring in that question, Sylvia, to our political leaders, not to people like you and Dean, who I speak to often. I also speak often to Bernie Sanders as well.
But I think we have a hard time sometimes getting our voices heard, let alone average workers. But yeah, I mean, the reason we're not seeing this kind of cry from Washington, D.C. is, like I said, it's the same reason we can't get the minimum wage increase.
Right.
Because they are bowing to the pressures of lobbyists, and they need the money that comes from the moneyed interests for their political campaigns.
Well, Sylvia Allegretto, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
You're very welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Sylvia Allegretto, who is a labor economist and co-chair of the Center on Wage and Employment Dynamics at the University of California, Berkeley. She has co-authored several editions of The State of Working America, and her research interests include long-term unemployment, family budgets, low-wage labor markets, inequality, and minimum wages. We're going to take a brief station break, and on this day where we learn of the death of Nelson Mandela, of course, which should remind us of racial justice, human rights, and reconciliation, we are going to cover what is actually happening in Africa today in the Central African Republic.